Of our subcommittee, since we don't have a quorum of senators here yet, but it's time to begin, and we want to respect your schedules and the time you had to get up in the morning to be here. We know what that is like, and we thank you for being here. We also would like to remind you that we'll be testifying today that these proceedings are watched over the internet and are rebroadcast on cable TV all over the state, and so it's important for us to identify ourselves when we first begin so that people know who's speaking and speak up and just, you know, let's make this a good presentation for the citizens who we hope will be watching this by the tens of thousands. Also, for our committee, I'd like to just remind them that with the new process that the co-chairs have agreed to follow, this is part of phase one, which will be focusing on getting an overview of the various agencies and programs and to find out about their performance measures and to talk to them about their priorities and so forth, and that at the end of phase one, after about 6 weeks, we will get further instructions from the co-chairs, and then we will meet again to focus more on the actual numbers and those kinds of things. Nevertheless, if there's something you feel really needs to be answered, you know, just let me know, and we will go ahead and ask the questions. So with that, Sheila Baker, where are we at for today?
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, today and tomorrow we'll be hearing from the agency and some from some partners of the agency. The agenda is before you. I'd also point out that there is the budget bill related to this in front of you, Senate Bill 5505, because this is, even though we won't be focusing on the numbers, this is a budget hearing. And so this, I think, is, for some of you at least, your first look at what a budget bill looks like. And you can see there that there are numbers, but not much detail as to what those numbers mean. And so that's the reason that we have the budget hearings. So, with that, I'll turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we'll start with an overview of the commission system from, and we'll hear from Samuel Henry, the chair of the Commission on Children and Families, and John Yunker, commissioner on the Commission on Children and Families. Could you please step forward? We welcome you today. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning. Before you begin, we'll go ahead and close this subcommittee meeting and open the regular subcommittee meeting for Ways and Means Human Services for the day. Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Samuel D. Henry, EDD, Chairman of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, Associate Professor of Education at Portland State University, and the father of 13-year-old Antonia Zilla Madeline Henry. Today, February 1st, 2005, we celebrate the day of birth of 124 babies in Oregon. Tomorrow, we will also celebrate about that same number. Today is a day of opportunity because today we can stand for the obligation that Oregon has to invest in these 124 new babies. 21 years from today, these new babies of today will become the adults who fill our jobs, run our organizations, vote in our elections, parent our neighbors' children, and pay our taxes. Today, it is our job to continue to build with them and with each other the frameworks of economic and social stability, the constructs of health and independence, and to lay the foundations of compassion for their communities, along with the courage and intelligence to address and collectively solve our social problems. If we succeed today, our work together will be our state's shining legacy. If we fail, that chasm of hopelessness and despair, that too will be our enduring legacy. Speaking of legacies, 10 years ago in this very building, a group of people got together with their neighbors in the Oregon State Legislature, convinced that we could make Oregon a better place for children and families. At that time, we were probably the first state to take such a comprehensive look at the needs of children and families in the context of communities. Together, we examined carefully our work to date, and we were honest with each other about its strengths, its gaps, and the wishes we still had for the least powerful. Then we added decisive action to address those needs, and we became the envy of many. Since then, many other states, and indeed several countries, have used our collaboration of D's and R's and I's, and all others of us, named and unnamed, affiliated and unattached, as a model for getting citizens involved in their communities and for building a web of support for our children. Today we have a system of local commissions in all 36 of Oregon's counties that, along with the State Commission, engages communities in building the supports that children and families need. I am proud to have been a part of this effort from the start. When Multnomah County called me, I wondered why a little-known college professor living in tiny Troutdale should be invited to join in this endeavor with his neighbors, but the answer was quickly obvious. Over the next 9 years, I sat with Senator John Lynn and Reverend Luther Sturtevant, with former police chief Tom Potter, with attorneys Lee Coleman and Mark Rosenbaum, with Pauline Anderson and child care team member Leslie Haynes, who's now passed away, and dozens of our neighbors, including welfare mothers, Native American tribal representatives, small business owners, and child care providers. Together, we pursued the dream of creating and maintaining support for a better Oregon at the local level. Together, we invested thousands of hours in building these supports for children and families, and we noticed that the same thing was happening in LeGrand and in Hood River, in Grants Pass and Benton and Deschutes. We have become more than a government agency, more than a collective of service providers, more than an association of advocates. Last spring, in my role as chair of the OCCF, Oregon Commission on Children and Families, I don't want to feed the kitty there, Mr. Chairman, I decided to get around to an armful of counties to hear firsthand what local communities were up to and to see how they continue to fulfill the 10th year of promise. I witnessed a passionate discussion of Healthy Start in Wasco County, and I saw Sheriff Anderson give a community service award to the 16-year-old son of a Hispanic migrant worker in Tillamook, while his classmates, his high school principal, and his family looked on with great pride. And I also heard firsthand from three-fourths of the counties I visited about the deadly community scourge of meth addiction. And I saw the stubbornness of dozens of Oregonians about their resolve to excise that cancerous community blight with all of our support. So if you ask me, what did we do with our 10 years? And why can't our colleagues in DHS do what we do? Or why, you ask me, why does the commission system make a difference? I point to our record of addressing difficult and complex issues like child abuse, and our ongoing successes in engaging whole communities and untold miracles of leveraging resources. I remind you that every dollar we receive from the State General Fund meets $3 from other sources, and that we are truly a statewide and local partnership, with most of the crucial decisions placed in the hands of your neighbors and mine in local communities, in what folks from around the country are calling thoughtful, planful community action. As a member of a local commission, I saw the difference we made. As a state commissioner, I continue to see the need to support our counties, our system, and the critical programs of relief nurseries, Healthy Start, and CASA, the court-appointed special advocates. Last fall at a meeting, I met with my counterpart from the state of Ohio, and he asked me the same question that a woman from the Czech Republic had asked me a couple of summers ago when I was bragging about our system at a UNESCO conference in Finland. How do you do that? They don't ask, why do you do that, or who do you do that for? They understand that what we give to children today is what society gets back in the future. What about our children? I have vivid memories of being present at the birth of my own daughter, Antonia. I remember her wet and shiny, her full head of hair sticking out every which way, her forehead wrinkling, and the enormous loud cry she sang out at 8:12 on that August evening. In fact, it was a cry so loud that one of the nurses later told me that they could hear her in the next door delivery room. It was her vocal heritage from her granddad, now passed from this earth, who was a Pentecostal minister, and he would preach to open-air services with more than 1,000 people, all without the benefit of a microphone or amplification. I see her now, and I remember that birth, and I can still hear that cry. I treasure the memories, I eagerly embrace her present, and most of all, I hold myself accountable for her future. Today, there will be 124 new babies born in Oregon, each a joy, each an obligation, each an opportunity for us to renew our commitment to their and our future. We, the members of the Commission on Children and Families, have come to work with you and with our neighbors in every community in Oregon to celebrate that joy, to provide for that obligation, and to seek the full measure of this opportunity. Thank you very much for what you've done with us in the past. Thank you for what we will continue to do. Thank you for this chance to share our hope for our babies together.
Thank you, Chair Henry. Any comments or questions for Mr. Chairman? All right, thank you. We'll move on then to John Yunker, Commissioner, Commission on Children and Families.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am John Yunker, a retired citizen of the city of Salem now, and I appreciate the opportunity to visit with you. I'm just going to spend about 5 or 6 minutes to give you a little idea about what's unique in this commission as far as the budget process and how we do business. And you already noticed, I think, that we have a great chair and are very fortunate. And things, frankly, if some of you who know a little of my background, that goes back into the 70s and 80s, I have been so impressed with my service on this commission and how well it works and how unique it is compared to a lot of state operations. And I don't mean that they're not doing a good job. I just mean the way we do business is unique in the amount of coordination and working with the local communities and being sure that they have the decisions and the commitment of their community and the flexibility to respond to their needs within their community. That's a nice feeling, and we've made a lot of progress in the last 10 years. I'm supposed to mention a few things here, but I know that the people behind me, Mickey Lansing and some of her folks, are going to deal in more detail about what Healthy Start is and how well it works and those kinds of things, but I'll hit a couple of thoughts on the way here. Obviously we work primarily in areas of young children and child abuse prevention, and engaging our communities and leveraging resources on childhood child abuse prevention. Again, you'll hear great detail, but the real issue here is the more you can do for the child in the early years, the better it will be. And the more you can do for the family to help them and therefore they put them in a position to be able to spend more time in nurturing and helping their child, the better they will be. So there's a lot of wraparound services required for these programs. There isn't a one-size-fits-all. There isn't one program that makes it all work. It's being sure that there is a net of different programs that are working together, that are coordinated, that are there for those families and for those children. And that's what the State Commission does primarily, is be sure that we have looked at the needs statewide and all the various issues that those families and those children need, and then try to coordinate it and make it available and support our communities in providing those services. There are a few at the State Commission level direct programs that the state is involved in, like Healthy Start and the funding, at least partial funding for our relief nurseries and those things. But our primary job is to help those communities be successful and be sure that they have the flexibility that they need and that they have a broader view of all the various needs that are available, needs that are there, and the resources that are available, and that they can leverage those resources. And it is exciting to see that just a few dollars from the State Commission combined with the local dollars, combined with business community money, and a nonprofit support in the community, and maybe some federal dollars, how far you can go on with those dollars and how much you can do. So there's a lot of leveraging, and I think we used to say, I don't know if we say this anymore, but I believe that the people of the state are getting a lot for their dollar in these investments, a bigger bang for their dollar, I guess is what they used to say in the 70s. In addition to what we do in engaging communities and leveraging resources, I talk a little about the budget process, which is also unique compared to my experience in some of the other areas in state government. It's unique because we do involve, but it's the way to do it. State agencies that are involved, such as DHS, Employment Division, and Education. We work with the direct programs that we support, Healthy Start, Relief Nurseries, CASA. We work with the local commissions for all of the counties in the state. And they are all present and at the table when we work out through a consensus process our priorities and our needs. And that's not an easy job because obviously there's a lot of different people coming from different directions. But it is working very well. They have a mutual understanding and respect for each other. And the answer, they understand that the solution to the issues for our families at risk and our children is that we all have to work together. And it's doing well. We have quite a few meetings on those subjects, and I guess the only downside is a lot of people have to travel a long ways to attend, but they do make it to the meetings and they do participate. And other than that, I guess I would do better. Chair here is a much better public speaker than I am. I do a little better, I hope, at answering any questions you may have about the budget process or who's involved or any issues that you may know as far as your local community regarding the budget process.
Questions from the committee?
Well, I don't have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But I think you're being pretty modest. Having been around this building for a lot of years.
I was going to say that, too.
I'm glad you did.
And having seen a lot of evolutions, and, I mean, you were here when I was here, and you were here when the department and some of these were created. And so looking back in time and just kind of going forward, because you're still involved, and you're involved in as a volunteer. And I think that says volumes of you've left this building as a, which was in putting the very budgets that we're sitting here grappling with at one time from the executive branch, the governor's office, and now you come back to be a volunteer. And I just want to know, there has to be some passion there that's saying get you back into this building. I'm going to put you on the spot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters. It's not easy after you retire to find a job where you can still have passion and be excited and make a difference. And I'm very honored to be on the Commission on Children and Families. And I wouldn't still be on it if I wasn't very impressed with what they're doing and how much difference they're making. I guess you're asking a personal question, and I normally am a little nervous around those things. But frankly, I think we all have something in our background where you know, I came from a family that had issues and problems, and I can remember getting a quarter from my mom and getting on a bus when I was 8 years old and going downtown and hanging out at the YMCA to try and stay out of trouble. So, yes, I have a passion, and I am very excited about the progress we're making.
I'd like to say, Mr. Yonker, that you exemplify what Benjamin Franklin taught, and that is that you spend the first half of your life taking from society. You know, you take your education, your business, you earn your money, you raise your family, and then the second half of your life is to give back. And so you've been in training for the last 30 years for what you're doing now, and we appreciate you coming forward and doing that. And the real measure of a person is what they do when they don't have to do anything. And so when you no longer have to work for financial purposes, then comes a real question as to how will you spend your time, self-focused or others-focused. And so I hope that we all will take the example and give back like you're doing now, and we encourage you to continue to do so for a lot of years.
Yes, Chairman.
Senator Carter.
Welcome, Dr. Henry, too. I heard his silver tongue as I was preparing to come down here, and welcome to John. It's good to see you back. My question is, how can we pull together an army of people to better protect our children? One death in this state from child abuse is too much, let alone the 35, John, that we had in the 80s in 1 year. I don't believe that the total job lies with DHS. I think it lies with within our community, with the commission, and with other agencies, because the thing that you and I both know, and most everybody in this room know, DHS is damned if they do and damned if they don't. You know, I remember the case in Hillsboro with the Army major, and they took the kid out of the home, and everybody was in arms about them doing too much. Then I remember the kid being killed down in Ashland. They didn't do enough. How do we pull an army? How do we raise the consciousness of this state in terms of all of us having to share in the responsibility of our children and their lives? Both of you, please.
You want this?
Well, I'll go first, and I have backup here. They'll do a better job. But I couldn't agree more, Senator. I mean, government can't raise children.
That's right.
Government can help in some ways. Government can be there for specific issues, for short-term issues particularly. But helping the families with their parenting, helping the children when they're young, through the families is the best way, and then you go from there. It is the families first. It is the community second. Government's like third or fourth on a list of resources that can help solve that problem. And each one is unique, which, again, government doesn't do well when things are extremely complex and very unique. And we don't have the staff or the resources to eliminate those issues. It has to come at the family level kids and families when they first start out. And whatever you can do for them and whatever resources you can do to help them be successful, that's where you need to do it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carter, I obviously agree with John, and thank you all for recognizing the work that others like John, who are so-called retired, bring to the commission. The issue that you raise is critically one that has to be dealt with and solved in communities. And as I alluded to, we are more than an agency. We are those communities. We are those 36 separate groups of people working at addressing issues of child abuse and other issues too, in a regular and systematic fashion. But it's also an issue of all of us, and that's the role that, quite frankly, you have asked us and some others to play, and we certainly appreciate finding better ways to bring this to the attention of our neighbors. We ask that people think about what this connectedness means and what this sense of responsibility is. one of the attractions of moving to Oregon, as I did, boy, it's getting longer and longer now, huh? Was that the sense of community that emanates from Oregon. And one of the joys of working on the Commission on Children and Families, both at the county level and at the state level, is to see that in operation. There are huge issues that we must deal with, and we cannot minimize them by ignoring them, but at the same time we have to find collective strategies, and we're dedicated to working with our counterparts in the counties and our counterparts statewide to address those issues.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
My concern comes sometimes when we are not as good of collaborators from agency to agency. And people holding their cards so close to the chest. So it's really nice to hear that the Commission and Children's, you know, and DHS is working together. But somewhere along the line, I'm hoping this committee will think of other ways in asking these folk, who are the other people that have the assignment of children, that we can bring more of them together to the table. And even if it's private enterprise and they having some state dollars, how do they work together to be assured? Let me just ask one other question. How many kids, Sugar, maybe you have them, how many deaths did we have of child from child abuse in the state last year?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, I don't recollect. I believe it was up a little bit from the year before, but the couple years before had been down. So it is very variable. But I do have that number. I will bring it to the committee.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm saying one is too much. And so how do we broaden the circle? So that that we engage institutions that are so assigned to caring for our children, and each one is like teach one, but each one is helping to identify the issues as they see them with our children. That is too much.
I think that you have brought up a kind of a guiding principle that we need to follow throughout the session. In your question as to how do we get more people involved, because the answer is not going to be by expanding the agencies.
That's right.
It's going to be by community involvement.
Yeah.
Well, we do not need bigger government. We need bigger citizenship.
That's right.
And we need strengthening our communities, and we need help to know how to do that. For instance, you know, John, and you know, you're retired, but you're writing your legacy. You know, you're writing your obituary now. And shouldn't we all be doing that? We don't know when we're going to die, but what do we want people to say about us when we die? What do you want people to say? And so wouldn't it be good for each of us to determine what we want to be remembered for now, and then live the life between now and that day, whenever it is, so that we fulfill our own expectation for ourselves instead of just having it happen. You know, he lived and then he died. You know, R.I.P., well, wouldn't it be better to be able to say he made a difference in the lives of not only one child, but many children,
yeah,
or in families, strengthened families in a way that would have not happened without him? I mean, these are the things that give life meaning. People are retiring younger, many of them, and living longer. And so the real question is, what are you going to do with those years? I mean, how many movies can you watch? And how many trips can you take? And when can you really make a difference in the world around you, so that our legacy isn't like having a glass of water and our life is like a finger and we stick it in it and then we die and we pull it out. I mean, it's like there's nothing to be remembered for. You have children. That's wonderful. Your legacy is also assured by your children and their children and the generations that follow. But we can expand that because we are a community. And if we strengthen communities, we have greater hope than if we merely try and get additional funding when we know good and well that the system can't be sustained by merely having somebody else take care of it. And so OCCF is involved with helping communities strengthen so that people can be greater citizens.
Senator Carter mentioned the number of deaths and whether that had increased. I'm a little tired this morning because at 4 o'clock this morning I went out on a drug raid. I would encourage every member of this panel, if you can get your sheriffs and people to take you out to see the real world out there. And, you know, we talked about the death, but there's also children that when you go to these raids, we had added two more this morning to temporary shelter and care. If I sound my voice is weary, that's because I didn't sleep last night because I had to get up at 3 and I didn't want to miss. I didn't want to oversleep. So anyway, but it is about communities and the commission has showed us that top-down planning doesn't work. Because what they're talking about is that the plans are evolving from the community in which where the agencies are and where people live. And I think that this body needs to keep that in perspective. None of these 36 plans are alike. They all focus on the needs and inside of their own respective communities. I just had to add that because I don't want us to just think about one piece of abuse and neglect. Because when you examine it, it is far bigger, and those numbers are going up, up, up.
Thank you. That's absolutely true. Due to time constraints, we will move forward. Thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Now we'll hear from Mickey Lansing. Mickey, I'm going to rely on you to keep track of how we're doing and make sure that we are finished.
For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I'm the director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. Chair Richardson and members of the committee, I am so pleased to be here today, and I cannot go further without saying a special thank you to both our volunteer state commissioners, our Chair Samuel Henry and John Yunker. And especially, I have to, Samuel has been so supportive. He's a professor at Portland State University, but he spends hours and hours of his own time on weekends, in the evening, trying to figure out the same kinds of things that you are struggling with today in terms of what else can we do. John Yunker comes and visits the office at least every other week, sits down and says, "What is it that I can do? How do you need our help?" Those are the kinds of people that have been so instrumental in ensuring that we are successful, both at the state level and the local level. And I feel, I have to say, I truly feel grateful for that kind of commitment on their part to what it is that we all do. With that, I am going to quickly go through history and mandate. I am going to try and summarize and what I call translate, because much of the material you have in your book is what I call statutory language, etc. So I am going to be as clear as I possibly can as I go through this. First of all, the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, as it exists today, has been in place for approximately 10 years. In 1993, as the result of the Children's Care Team, we were created. At that particular time, you really asked us to do four things. And you see under your history and mandate, there is a 10-year history piece, and then there's also an Oregon Commission on Children and Families mandate that talks about several things. You can refer to those if you'd like, but let me just talk about what they say. We were created in 1993, and we were really created to do four things. To engage communities so that they invested in solutions on behalf of their kids. To build a support system for ages 0 to 18 years of age by convening and facilitating other agencies, both public, private, nonprofit, and the community in making decisions for kids, to focus on prevention, and especially in the early childhood years, but also all along the continuum, at the front end of each of the systems, no matter where they fell, and then to leverage resources, those private resources and community, federal resources, foundations, all of the other things, not only money, but the resource of time. because citizens, people, are the ones that are going to make the difference. So those are the first things that you asked us to do when we were first created. We got up and running in 1997. And these are some points in history. One of the things that we did is we created an accountability system. We worked with Dr. Claire Pratt from Oregon State University on how is it that we can train local communities in looking at outcomes and how are they going to know that when they fund certain programs, they do certain things, that they can get measurable outcomes. What is the evidence? What is the research? What do those things say? We were the only ones at that point that had that particular piece in our statute that we must fund programs. We must fund programs where that get measurable outcomes. In 1999, Senate Bill 555 passed. Senate Bill 555 really did two things. It sent a block of dollars to local communities for the prevention of juvenile crime to really look in their particular areas what's happening. So again, that we could have a continuum starting with early childhood through 18 years of age, and local communities could make decisions about what was best for their children in their community. And it also clarified the role of the local commission system, that they would gather together. And yesterday, remember, you heard from Partners for Children and Families. They clarified that the commission system role, and I must tell you, it's both at the state level and the local level, is to gather people around the table, the professionals, the other agencies, and look at what is happening for kids. What are the priorities in our communities? What are the strategies that we together are going to use to address these particular issues? In 2001, the Children's Plan was passed. And this was not a program, but it was a system of services. And it was a commitment to our early childhood system in the belief that the earlier you're able to address issues with children, the better off they're going to be, and that we need an early childhood system in every county. And we need programs like Healthy Start, which was then, it was in 18 counties prior to 2001, rolled out to all 36 in 2001. And I must say, the collaboration between Healthy Start, Babies First, which is a nurse home visitation out of the Health Division, Maternity Case Management and Family Health, and Cocoon, which is a program run out of Oregon Health Sciences University that addresses medically fragile and high-needs babies. We are all working together to ensure that we don't duplicate services and we provide the best possible support that we can. And this is a new thing for us.
Nikki, talk to me about, you know, because I was a part of all of this coming along, but my concern was then, and Doctor, I'd like for you to talk a little bit about this when you get a chance to come back. Talk to me about tertiary care, because when we started the primary care system, and we had tertiary care up here, that means some kids were left out, and those kids that were left out are now our kids that we can profile in terms of being gangbangers and all of the rest of them. Now, and my question then as it is today is, how do we as a state, and I agree with John Yonker, the state cannot do individualized care when it becomes a unique situation. But when we think collectively of what is happening to our kids in the Oregon Youth Authority, and when they graduate from the Oregon Youth Authority and go on to the state prison system, somewhere along the line, a group is being left out. So who has the responsibility, if not the commission, with tertiary care? And where are we there? And, Doctor, at some point, you and I can talk on that, because I'd like to know if there are any plans, any strategies in terms of evidence-based practices that are going on in this state that still deal with tertiary care, because we cannot forget those kids.
Chair Richardson, Senator Carter, in answer to your question, the only thing I can say to you is, number one, it's all of our responsibility in terms of those kids. That's why those supports all along the continuum are so critical. And I'm going to talk just in a couple of minutes about the system and what happens to kids when they don't get what they need. But because we are now working together through Partners for Children and Families, both at the state level and at the local level, I think we have a much better chance of doing what it is that we need to do. OIA has been a great partner. Department of Human Services, great partner. Oregon Department of Education, for the first time in the last year and a half, is coming to the table. And we're starting to not only look at what kids need, but what resources are there that we have that we can start to align in a way that's going to get the greatest impact. I don't have all the answers to your questions, but we would love to talk to you more about that. But the good news is that we are addressing issues that we've never addressed before in the way in which we're doing that.
Thank you.
Okay. So, 2001, the Children's Care Plan. We looked, rolled out Healthy Start statewide. We said that relief nurseries need to also be statewide. But we knew that there were not the available resources at that time. We'll talk later on about that particular issue. At the same time, we also passed House Bill 2082, and that was a bill that addressed community learning centers. And that particular legislation said that the Oregon Department of Education, the Commission on Children and Families, the Criminal Justice Commission, and the Department of Human Services need to gather together and they need to develop and implement community learning centers on a statewide basis. And the reason why community learning centers, let me tell you, can be looked upon as family resource centers, full-service schools, lighted schools. They are called many different things. They can be located at a school or they can be linked to a school. But the reason why that legislation was important is that what we know is when you wrap around other supports around the school setting, you get better outcomes for kids and their families, especially those kids who live in poverty. So you're talking about before and after school programs, you're talking about mentoring, tutoring, you're talking about health clinics in terms of immunizations. You could have Healthy Start, you could have child care, you could have English as a second language, employment training for parents. I mean, a host of resources located at those particular sites. Those are the important milestones in, I would say, in the last 10 years. As I said to you earlier, in terms of mandate, you really asked us to do four things. And we, through the last 10 years, believe that we are making a difference. We have formed that foundation in order to provide some kind of a safety net for Oregon's children. I want to talk briefly to you now about our system and exactly who we are. The Oregon Commission on Children and Families is made up of a state commission that's 17 people. Two are appointed by the Senate, one by the Senate, one by the House. It is the director of the Department of Human Services. It is the superintendent of public instruction. It is two business people. It is the director of the employment department, because the employment department has all the federal child care dollars. It is six community members. It's somebody representing the Juvenile Directors Association. It's someone representing a provider of services locally. And so it is a combination of people, a diverse group that has knowledge about kids' issues, again, 0 to 18 years of age. And actually, the State Commission plays a very critical role with the state agency office. They actually oversee our work to some degree. And then we have 36 local commissions on children and families. The state agency staff at this particular point, if you go and look, I have several things in the notebook, but we have an organization chart of state agency staff that includes limited duration positions as well as our full-time staff, which is approximately 24 positions. There is also a piece here on what we call local intermediary organizations. This was done by a think tank, but if you read this particular piece of information. It very clearly describes what local commissions do. You also have in your book, it's called Components of the Local Commission on Children and Family System. So when you think about most counties in the state of Oregon only have two FTE. Pardon?
Oh, sorry.
Oh. Look through this components document and see what our expectations of them are. The state commission, the state office, is under the authority and direction of the executive department. Local commissions are under the authority of their local boards of county commissioners. That was done intentionally because they wanted to make sure that anything the state sent locally, the local people had decisions locally about what they were able to do with those particular pieces.
Okay, Senator Carter.
You know, that sounds good sometimes, but where does the buck stop? Does it stop with the state or does it stop with locals?
Chair Richardson, Senator Carter, that's an interesting question.
Very interesting.
And that's a question that we struggle with and at times offers real challenges to us. Because in our legislation, the state has some authority to do some things. But let me tell you how we try to approach it in the commission system. We've always approached working with local people because they are us and we are them in a developmental way. We're not as much about regulating or ensuring that everything is according to compliance. We are what we call developmental. So we try to look at where people are and what are their needs so that we can help them get to that next particular place. However, there are issues at times around how dollars are being spent, and I must say that is so much the exception rather than the rule. But other issues of authority that we do have to address. Thankfully, in my 11 years with the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, there have been very few times when we have been at a place where we've had to do something that caused lots of consternation.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I ask that question because I've had several incidences with constituents, and I, as a state representative of government, as a state senator, I can't call my state people and say, can you look into this? Let me say this. I don't feel as if I can do that simply because we are a conduit to the local area, and the state has no leverage. And I think that that's a problem. But maybe I'm just the only one. Maybe that's the uniqueness of my situation.
Are you thinking that there should be state oversight?
I think there should be something. If the state is going to pay the money to local communities, I think the state should have something. Should have something to say. I certainly do.
Okay. Would you take a moment and tell us what is the relationship as far as supervisory, position between your office and the county?
Chair Richardson, Senator Carter. We are able, through our legislation, to hold dollars if, in fact, the local commission or Board of County Commissioners is not doing what needs to be done.
Okay.
As I said before, and there's been very seldom that we have had to do that. I must tell you.
You have that leverage.
But we have that leverage if we have to use it.
Okay, thanks. Yeah. That's good. Yeah.
Thank you. I want to go now. Our system, to some degree, we've always struggled with how is it that we really describe what we do and how we do it. And I wonder if I could get this board over here because I want to talk to you about this particular piece. We had to move it because it was in front of the camera. And we want you to know that, yes, it is in color. You all have pieces at your desk. But it was paid for with private dollars.
Let's put it
we won't hold that
against over there, okay? So that it's facing the audience as well as us.
Okay, that's gonna be fun.
Just like that, that's good. I mean, that way people can see it.
Mr. Chair and committee members, as Mickey indicated, there is a handout at your place that replicates that chart as well. So for people like me who can't really read that. this is more helpful.
It does give the audience the idea of what's going on as well.
Hopefully you can see it. So this really says the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, so that's not really an accident.
Yeah. Having defined it, I see that you do the limitation of space and ink.
I want to talk to you. This, we've tried to describe how does our system really work. And keep in mind what you heard yesterday from Partners for Children and Families, the other agencies that work together in that local community planning. What we know is that we map locally to see what are the supports that kids need to have in their local community. We map the strengths of the communities, we map the resources, the assets, what are the gaps, what are the barriers. But what we know, these are all issues. Each county has an array of public and private supports. So the local comprehensive community plan maps the network of support, and they identify all those things we just talked about that exist in communities. When we find that there are gaps and a community needs more, we take, in the commission system, the locally invested dollars that have some flexibility to them, as well as our designated program dollars, like Health Start and Leave Nurseries, et cetera. And we try to fill the gap around how is it that we really do child abuse prevention. And Healthy Start has a universal aspect in terms of its support. We know we need to invest in early childhood. We know we need to access high-quality child care. We know we need to engage citizens in this whole process. We know we need to link communities with schools. When somebody said, Senator Carter, it's not education alone that is responsible for educating our kids. Communities have to wrap around and support them. We have to support our youth all along the continuum through 18. And this is something that we really have started to do in the commission system, is leverage public and private dollars and start to develop those private partnerships. We at the state level are working with 5 foundations now to see how is it we can take the results of this local community planning and start to leverage those resources. We can help foundations in making their decisions as they give dollars to local communities based upon what those communities have said they need. So we take our dollars, we try to form the supports at this level. If we can't support children, those kids may have to go into what we call more intensive Healthy Start services, those higher risk families. Relief nurseries, who do a wonderful job with those high risk families. They take, again, and have many different supports for them. Court-appointed special advocates. While these kids have been in an out-of-home placement and have been abused, 98.4% are not re-abused if they are assigned to CASA. And then there are other targeted prevention services that the community can support kids and their families with. But again, we're starting to get more costly in terms of what our dollars need to go to. And if, in fact, all of these things don't work, kids slip down into juvenile crime. They may have mental health issues, suicidal, need treatment. They're abused and neglected. They have parents who are unemployed and unable to contribute to society. There's alcohol and drug addiction, meth being, again, you heard yesterday from Jackson County, the huge issue that that is. They have poor health, and many live in poverty. The further we get into the system, the more costly it is. So if those supports are not available, kids and families drop down through this particular web of supports and have to access a more costly system.
Just a moment, please.
Try to do
Representative Henson. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mickey, what percentage of the kids that are involved in juvenile dependency issues receive a CASA worker?
30%.
Okay. Thank you.
30%. Okay. Please continue. We're about halfway through our committee meeting today.
Okay. So,
is that helpful to you in terms of understanding what we try to do? Is that we're up in this particular area and make sure that kids don't get to this point. But if they do, we're going to work in partnership with other agencies to try and see that they get what they need through public and private resources.
Now I'm going to come to my most favorite time, and that's because I get to introduce the local commissions. That's where the work really is done. That's where people live, that's where they play, that's where they go to school, and that's where they work. And what we've tried to do today is give you a snapshot of the work of two different local commissions and how making those connections really has built a support base in their local communities. So, first of all, I want to call Hood River, and I especially want to say Hood River has brought with them another state commissioner who is a volunteer. Joella Detman is the director of the Hood River Commission on Children and Families, and she will introduce her local participants.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we were delighted to get up before 5 o'clock this morning to come visit you.
We welcome you. Thank you for being here.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Today I'm just delighted to be able to introduce two people who are very involved in our community but who do not receive any commission funds. First, we have Claudia Montano. She is a program manager for the Next Door Incorporated. They're our big nonprofit in Hood River County, although they serve some other counties too. She does Hispanic outreach or Latino outreach and community mobilization work in the community. She's really done a big job there. And how long have you been
since
doing that?
99.
I've also brought Tom Schaefer, and Tom Schaefer is community volunteer extraordinaire. He's been a member of the commission since its inception. He has been a past chair. He's now representing the local or rural communities on the OCCF, State Commission. He is an advocate for children. He sits on a number of boards in the community, the county, and the region, and he also works directly with kids on a number of activities. He's a Leo leader, Young Lions, Leos. That's really cute, and he's working diligently to get our kids to go to college. I want to pass off to them and have them talk to you about what's going on in our little community, our little county.
Good morning. My name is Claudia Montano, for the record. I want to thank you for allowing me to be here this morning, and I also want to be very honest with you. I do not envy the task that you have at hand. I know it's very difficult decisions that you'll make, and that I thank you for your time and your effort to continue to serve Oregon residents. And when I was thinking about this, when Joella approached me on this, how are we going to share this information with you, what came to mind was a few months ago, I was attending a conference, and a group of us went to go see a movie called Un Día Sin Los Mexicanos, which translated means A Day Without Mexicans. It's a mockumentary. It was a farce. It was some of the stuff was just hilarious, from the INS crying because all the Mexicans had left the state of California. And it was all the impact was concentrated on just the state of California. So it only showed how the crops were going to be affected and so forth. So some of it was some satire, some was very plausible, others were, it gave a lot of food for thought. And so I thought, you know, what would Hood River County be without the Commission on Children and Families? So we started listing out a lot of things. I work with private foundations, grant applications that require matches. I work with federal monies that require 100% matches. So if we're going out for $100,000, that means we have to leverage $100,000. So I have a list here that I wanted to talk about with you. And one of them is there would be no focus to serve all families on an equal basis. There would be service gaps and service duplications. There would be no capability to leverage in what I have, since I started working with them, the $3.6 million in funds that include the mandate to implement culturally appropriate programs in Hood River County. There would be no Healthy Start program. Programs that would be implemented in the community would not be research-based and would not be programs that are proven to be effective to work with the citizens or with the residents or with the children that they are targeting. There would be no local evaluation, which is very important for us that are applying. First of all, just to be responsive and responsible to our residents and our clients. There would just be programs that for a while there, they feel real good, they're touchy-feely type programs, but really there's no proof that they're effective. There would be no capacity building. The empowerment of the Hood River residents would be at an all-time low, we believe. And the community mobilization, the convening of community members to combat drugs and alcohol would be very limited because we see the Commission on Children and Family as an objective convener in our community. And with, of course, the target of the well-being of children and families in mind, obviously, so we're not too objective in that respect. There would be no youth activity funds. Kids would be left out because they have no money to be able to participate in certain programs. There would be no ability to be proactive and to react to the latest trends that there are. And the reason there wouldn't be that is because we wouldn't have no central data where all this would be compiled and all of their number crunching and all the data and receiving four different data sets of use and how to reconcile that to our community. The dropout rate for Latinos would be over 20% in Hood River County. The agencies and programs would continue to work in silos, and they would come to meetings and have their agenda, or as we all know, their hidden agendas. And no one would be pulling together. So that is the thing we see that would exist without the Commission on Children and Family. Tom will now talk with you about what he sees, what has happened in the last 10 years.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Tom Schaefer. I am a community volunteer in Hood River. As Joella said, I am the past chair of the Hood River County Commission on Children and Families. And I am now proudly serving as a member of the State Commission on Children and Families, representing, filling a seat for the Rural Commission seat. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'd like to begin by thanking the legislature for the wisdom in designing local commissions as conveners, coordinators, rather than providers of local services. This has allowed the local commissions to play a special role as an independent voice for the children and families in the communities. Since the creation of the local commission system, locally I have seen the convening of service providers with lay citizens, with a mapping of the community's assets for children and families, coordination of planning and agreement on short and long-term goals, funding decisions based on those goals and research-based expectations and evaluations. Seeing the commission as a resource for facts, statistics, information, assistance for all agencies looking for private and federal fund program grants, resulting in about a tenfold increase in private and federal funds through leveraging. I've seen capacity building through leadership training. I've seen the schools connecting with the community and inviting partnerships with private nonprofits for group work with at-risk students, resulting in Latino high school dropout rate reduced to the lowest in the state and a quadrupling of Hispanic students going on to college. That's very special for me. I have three of my kids have all gone to college, to very good schools. And I now work as a volunteer in the schools also to help counsel the kids on how, on the kids on the next steps and what's going to come afterwards. We have a lot of kids who are going to school who are the first generation in their family to graduate from high school, and they're going on to college. It's really special. The commission has also helped cut the teen pregnancy rate in half and kept parenting teams in school. And Hood River County retailers do not sell cigarettes to underage youth. That's also through our commission involvement. Coalitions bringing community members together to change norms around drug use and targeting drug prevention efforts with best practices. The police are partnering with the schools. We also have a positive Latino law enforcement relationship now in Hood River County. We have an involvement of the faith community to coordinate youth and family activities, including training and research-based best practices. Every early childhood provider meets regularly to monitor and improve the system serving families with young children. We recruited community service clubs to provide youth activity grants to increase low-income youth participation. And lastly, but not least, our commission has taken part in removing many of the barriers so social partners see funds as for children and families rather than funds just for their agencies.
I also wanted to add that in the mockumentary that I first mentioned, the moral of the story was an old one. You don't know what you have until it's gone. And that is not the case in Hood River County. We do appreciate everything that Commission on Children and Families, locally and statewide. We would not be able to be as effective as we are without them. They play a role that synergizes what little money is out there, and we can't imagine what it'd be like, just like I can't imagine California without Mexicans. I can't imagine what Hood River would be like without the Commission on Children and Families.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments from our committee?
Well, just Senator Wilson. Quick comment by way of a question. In your mockumentary, I mean, carrying that forward, you indicated the dropout rate would be over 20% for Hispanics. What is it now? I mean, you both mentioned.
I did the negative. He did the positive. I think it's been for the last 3-4 years under 3%.
Mm-hmm. Three?
Wow. I think it was 2.3.
Two point something.
And we started out, 20 would probably have been probably, when did we start? Probably about 96, 97, 1997. It's in talk about an incredible program. It was a program that came at a result, obviously, a needs assessment and a services gap. The community pulled together. We had a grant. We got some extra funds from the Commission and Families. We were able to fund that grant through a retention specialist through underage drinking prevention in the school. When those monies went away, the school was just so grateful for everything that's going on. They dug in for money, and of course they didn't have enough money, so the Commission on Children and Families through other funds were able to the juvenile crime prevention, and it's a true partnership, and it's run through the Commission on the Next Door Incorporated, which also picks up some of the benefits. So it's a true collaboration, and we still wouldn't be able to have that. In fact, now the middle schools are wanting to have that same student retention specialist specific to Latinos, specific to Mexican families in our community. Obviously, I want to applaud the fact that you allow, I know it's probably a nightmare, these 36 individual plans, but they are the experts within their own community to know if you have Russians, if you have Laotians, all the different ethnicities with their particular cultural needs. And to have these culturally competent programs implemented allows for this to happen. This was an incredible, in the first year, it was just amazing. It was, everyone was thinking back and talking about, man, we should have started this 10 years ago. You know, it's $25,000 for Anne, we want to say, and this is anecdotal, we're looking into it, but I was talking with one of the assistants in the school that assist the kids, not the student retention specialist. She was telling me that about 40% of the graduating Latinos, she has helped fill out FAFSA forms. So that is phenomenal, that 40% of the graduating Latinos are going on to score, at least are attempting, and she's going to do the follow-up on that. And she says she sits there, you know, in the graduation circles. Every single kid, she helped fill out the FAFSA, and we do group FAFSA fill-outs. And she, it's about 40%. And so it's incredible. But it's a wonderful example of what the Commission on Children and Families has been able to bring together to the table, because there's no hidden agendas there.
Well, the germ of genius in local commissions are the community-created solutions. And by any mark or measure, you know, 3%, 3.2, whatever the number is, that's an incredible mm-hmm. achievement, and you are to be congratulated.
Well, it's a community effort. We thank you on behalf of the community.
Mr. Chair, can I ask the commission, and particularly John, we often weigh performance based on certain statistics. In this case, we talked about the dropout rate, and we'll talk about what happens with child abuse neglect rates going down and these kinds of things. But has anyone done an analysis or an economic impact? And I'm thinking particularly, if the dollars went away, what is the economic, the job loss, number one, within your respective communities? Because what does that do with the economy inside of your communities? Because I think we know for each job and each dollar, there's this rippling effect that occurs in the community. And I realize that you're leveraging, but in addition to leveraging, there's some other things that are going on inside of your community as a result of what's happening through the commission. And I didn't know if you've done that kind of analysis. If you did, it may be something that you may want to think about. Because the creation of jobs is actually high on everybody's radar screen in this state. And if you take away, that means that's a job someplace is taken away. So just think about it, John.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Schaefer on your comment that the leveraging in your county is at about a 10-to-1, which is, you know, that's phenomenal. Would you mind, you know, to whatever extent you can, going into a little more detail about where you get a 10-to-1 leverage?
Go ahead. You know, it's my understanding that Oregon has the largest number of drug-free communities grants, and I think it's a direct response to what we're doing here, and that we have outcomes that we're measuring. We're working in prevention. We're doing that community outreach. We're saying that community mobilization is really important, and that's what drug-free communities grants funds. Our county has three of them. They're pretty much worth about $1 million over 10 years right now. They've just changed the rules. They've changed federal agencies that are managing them. They're saying if you're doing a good job, you can be funded for 10 years at about $100,000 a year.
Okay, did you say that your county was receiving $3 million annually or by?
No, over 10 years. So it'd be $100,000.
I mean, your share of the OF or OCCF's budget that comes to your county.
No. This is all separate.
That's all
separate.
Okay.
No. This is some federal dollars from SAMHSA for drug-free community grant. Our county has three of those.
Okay. Now let's set that aside.
Yeah.
You know what your budget is roughly from that your county receives from the OCCF?
Oh gosh, around $300,000. It's over $300,000. You know, I'm sorry, I keep my budget with everything that we get. So we get the J-bag dollars from state police. We get juvenile crime prevention. We pull in our drug-free communities grant. We have drug prevention.
Okay,
so I'm really looking at a broader picture, and we're running about $600,000.
What's our basic capacity?
About 178,000 is basic capacity for the biennium, and that's for the two staff, and it does not fund us.
Thank you. And the goal is not to really get real specific. It's just that you made a comment of 10-to-1 leveraging, and that perks me up, because anytime you can
investment
to get 100%, I'm pretty interested in that. But if that's not a specific thing.
Just to give you an example, though, too. And when we pulled out some of those figures, we keep track of every grant that we're involved with and specifically that we write. Most of them are for other agencies that we're participating in because we're not service providers. But the drug-free community grant that is actually coming through the commission, only one comes through our commission, two others are sitting out. And, well, Claudia actually has one for Latino outreach, and then there's one in Cascade Locks.
Okay.
They had some specific issues in that community that they needed to address. But ours is a faith grant. It's called Faith Connections, and it's trying to bring churches into this arena to teach them about best practices and build capacity there. So what's written into that grant is to teach them how to write grants, how to access funds, how to partner. These are some churches that aren't used to working with one another. We got churches on the ends of the spectrum there that are at the table going, oh, you want to do that with your kids? Hey, we got a van if you need to use that, or you can come use our facility. It's just wonderful watching that happen. But it is a process. It takes a lot of time to do it, and we needed some extra funds to make it happen. We didn't have them in the commission system. We had to go out and get them somewhere else.
Okay. Well, the utilization of community resources is just key. So congratulations on the great successes you're having. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'd now like to introduce Wendy Lebo from Multnomah County, who will introduce her local people.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Carter.
I'd like to welcome my constituent, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
Have you moved?
No.
I didn't think so, because if you do, you have to leave another constituent.
And she won't be as nice to you.
We welcome you, not only you, Constituent Brown, but all of you.
Thank
you're
you
all
very much.
Constituent.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, thank you very much. Wendy Lebo, Director of the Commission on Children, Families, and Community of Multnomah County, and we are very pleased to be here presenting today. With me, as you've heard, are our two volunteer commissioners on our local commission, Rich Brown, also with the Bank of America, and Thomas Wright with the American Research Institute, and our vice chair. I will start out with just a few brief examples about some of the most recent activities of the commission, and then Thomas will talk about some school-related initiatives, and Rich will finish up for us. One thing that at the commission we've paid attention to in the course of our planning work is the importance of connecting people to resources. We're a really different community, obviously, than Hood River County. And as you're aware, it's a complex environment. We play a little bit different role because of the size of the community, the complexity, and the number of organizations and folks involved there. So what we're aware of is that people often have a hard time figuring out where to get resources, how to connect to them. They don't know necessarily what they're eligible for, and it's a little confusing out there. It's even more confusing for folks living on a low income a lot of times. So we have several ways that we've been working on connecting people to the resources they're eligible for. Some of them are more traditional. The first one I will explain. The second one is much more high-tech. The first one is last year we became involved in the summer food program, which, as you're familiar with, provides free breakfast and lunch for low-income children. And those are children who are eligible for the free and reduced school feeding programs during the year, but during the summer they still need to eat, but that resource isn't available to them and their families as readily. Through some legislation during the last session, you all asked each local commission to convene the food service, the eligible districts, and we did that. We got together with the Hunger Relief Task Force and convened schools, service providers, the library, the parks, and other people who were interested or we thought should be interested in helping bring summer food to young people. And the meeting led to some new sites, to expansion of the library's programs at these sites when they realized the extent of the need, because, again, as other people have referenced, we pulled together the data, the demographics, and it became clear how great the need is in our community and where poverty has shifted dramatically. Also at that meeting, people talked about how hard it was to get the word out about these food sites, that they weren't getting as many participants as they would like to see. So we developed a series of outreach materials. We developed them and printed them and made them available to all of our partners. And we've got samples of them here. They were also developed with help from our youth commission, who gave input into them. and they can be tailored to any, and they're friendly and inviting, and they are available for local communities now statewide through the Oregon Department of Education's put them on their website so that they can be tailored to local communities. We also conducted surveys of parents and youth participants to find out how the program was working for them and for the recommendations. Basically, it was very positive, but they had some really good recommendations that we are working to implement with our partners. As a result of all these efforts, last year our summer food program usage increased by 56%, a total of almost 174,000 lunches were served last summer in Multnomah County. And we've written several grants since in partnership with the different agencies and providers to enhance access and programs for summer food. Another way we've linked resources, not the only one, but another one, our high-tech one, is through an eligibility website called Oregon Helps that you may have heard of. It's one of several web tools that have been created, and what it does is it links people to up to 28 different programs that they may be eligible for, including food stamps and WIC, tax credit programs, and others. It's also the official USDA food stamp eligibility estimator that's used. Since June of 2002, when this site was launched, more than 50,000 people in Oregon have accessed the website, 10,000 of them from Multnomah County, and the rest from around the state. So we, at the commission, provided early seed money to help launch the project. We communicate the community education portion. Staff and volunteers have trained more than 200 service providers and now some consumers in how to use the site. And in-kind contributions for the project have totaled well over $70,000 just for creating a public service announcement that's aired throughout much of the state. And it now operates on site licenses from selling the website to other states. The site's been evaluated. Over about 73% of website visitors completed the program and received results. And we've received many comments such as, I'm a single mother and don't have a lot of time to ferret out this information. I actually couldn't believe it was real at first. I really, really wish I had known about the site sooner. It saved me an immense amount of time, energy, and frustration. And then finally, the third example I'd like to talk about relates to child abuse and neglect. We have a network called the Community Safety Net for Child Abuse Prevention, and through that we fund a model program called the Family Advocate Model. And it's based on the best research, best practices model. And what it does is it takes families where there's a call to the child abuse hotline of the state Department of Human Services. There are about 250 calls each month to Multnomah County hotline where there's an indication of a serious problem within a family, but it doesn't it's not serious enough to warrant state involvement. So these families are referred to this family advocate program. It's a fairly short-term services. Advocates provide support. The families who they link with tend to have issues such as unemployment, mental health issues, child behavioral concerns, some pretty serious challenges that they're facing. The outcomes for this program are better than 2-to-1. They have they're much less likely to have a subsequent found a child abuse prevention case than other families who are referred and don't engage. To enhance this program, we have parent volunteers who've worked through the community safety net who want to make the program more accessible to more families so that they see the advantage of participating. And they also are talking about wanting a follow-up so that it can be even more effective and continue to support parents. And these parents are also starting to speak out in the community and to talk about how important it is to reach out and accept these services. So through that network, we've had a number of parents come through who are now speaking in the community about linking to services to help people who have less trust or don't feel comfortable when they're in this crisis with their children. And this is just one small piece of the whole sort of child abuse prevention web that we feel we're really creating and momentum. That's what I wanted to focus on. Would you like to talk about our school-related initiatives?
Sure. Okay, for the record, I'm Dr. Thomas Wright, and I'm the director of the American Research Institute. I'm also the vice chair of the Multnomah County Commission. I want to talk with you today about two things that I've been involved with somewhat. And one is the school partnership and the positive youth development that we've been directly involved with in the last couple of months. Last fall, we actually conducted a process of strength-based engagement with 70 youth high school students in two alternative programs. One school, Roosevelt, it's in North Portland. We did a process where we engaged the children and got their feedback, and it was quite exciting. We're talking about kids who feel mostly disengaged, and so when we actually went in and worked with those students, they became alive and they really saw how what they had to say really counted and made a difference. As they went through this process, they actually thought, "Oh my God, this is really working," and they found out that through consensus that they were concerned about their health clinic that was potentially going to be closed. What they did was they wanted to invite one of the commissioners to come to the clinic and come to them and talk with them, and they talked with the commissioner. And to make a long story short, I guess the clinic was saved. So they were really excited about that process. The other school we engaged the students in was in Centennial, and that was in East County. Same children with the same learning condition, they were in an alternative school. And that process really was helpful. They actually became excited as well. They saw that they could actually have an impact. The success of that engagement process was that the children, actually the students and the teachers, later on invited the parents to become involved in their whole school process. And so they were really excited that they actually had their voices heard. We will continue this process by working with the Native American youth, and we'll see how that process works. We're thinking, just based on the success of those two programs, that this too will be a very successful program. The other area I want to talk with you about today is our program, School Partnership, and how we're looking at evidence-based services to work with children who are in the school. Now, the Sun School program actually provides services to help children. They provide a number of services. I won't go through them all, but they provide services to help children who come to school with varying from varying environments in their home life. And so they try to intervene in those situations that would actually enhance their learning capacity. And we have found that the evidence-based programming that they've done have really been effective in ameliorating some of those conditions that impact the child's learning capacity. So we, and some of those, of course, you've been talking about already, you know, mental health conditions, drug poverty, single parenting. Those are all the kinds of things that children actually come to school with every day, and then they're asked to learn you know, and they may have been up all night. And they say, okay, stay awake now and learn, and they, you know, or they've had all these other conditions going on. So the Sun School programs have really been effective, and we really have worked to support that and keep that going. So we are looking at continuing to look at how best practices can and can serve the youth in our total community, both, you know, locally in Portland and in East County as well. So I thank you for having the opportunity to talk with you, and I'll turn it to Rich.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, my name is Rich Brown. I'm a senior vice president at Bank of America and a volunteer member of the Multnomah Commission on Children and Families. What I wanted to do is just real briefly, I think, reinforce some of the themes that you've already heard this morning, but from my perspective, I've been on the Multnomah Commission for about 18 months now, and wanted to share with you some of my thoughts on the value of the commission. And I think some people from time to time ask, you know, why have these local commissions? And very specifically, we help focus resources where they will do the most good. I think that is the key thing that we do. I see us having kind of a dual mission of as Wendy talked about, connecting current resources with those who need those resources and those who are eligible for those resources. Beyond that, I see us playing a very important role in developing a longer-term strategy around how we address the needs of children and the impact of early intervention in children's lives and what that can do both from a social standpoint and an economic standpoint, particularly over the long term. We are at the local level, we are the eyes and ears on the ground, and it's been really an eye-opening process for me to see our commission members come together, and we have business people, and we have some providers, and we have other policymakers, and to have all of us come together, and almost every single meeting there's an aha moment where people that are very knowledgeable about their niche go, wow, I didn't know that. I didn't know that you were doing that. And that kind of, I think, gets to the value of the commission, where we bring the policymakers, we bring the providers together to identify trends, to eliminate duplication, and identify where the most cost-effective places to put the limited resources that we know we all have that are dedicated to children. And you know, a simple way to put it is, I think, in a lot of ways, we help connect the dots. And As I was watching the 9/11 commission last year, and they were going through and looking at all the issues around 9/11, and what became clear out of all of that, and this has been reported over in the news, is that there was one part of government that had one set of information. There was another, the CIA knew one thing, the FBI knew the other, the National Security Council knew something else, but nobody put all that together to address 9/11. And I see that's what the commissions do, both at the state level and at the county level, that we can connect those dots and we can bring together both, again, the immediate needs to connect people with resources, but also dealing with demographic trends. In Multnomah County, we are seeing some really evolutionary trends in demographics and people moving east. Poverty is moving east within our county at a dramatic rate. And these are the things that we're looking at. And then we're saying, okay, from a demographic standpoint, how do we address where we put or where we help recommend where the next dollar should go? So it's more than just giving kids a voice, and that is very important to me, to give kids a voice. But it's also about the responsible use of taxpayer dollars, and I think I see that as a big part of our mission. And I think, just to wrap up, that we feel, and I hope that we can be both a compass and a map for policymakers at the state level and our county commissioners and those that are on the ground delivering the services. And that's what I see the real value as the commission. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Questions or comments?
I just have one question. Given the sheer size of Multnomah County, how many commission members do you have, and do you have subcommittees and what have you? I was sitting here listening to you, and my mind went back to when I was involved in planning for the multi-service center and some of those other endeavors, and I thought how huge it must be now in comparison when it was in 1969 and 70. Just the mere numbers and the demographics.
We have about 24 volunteer commissioners on our board, and you're absolutely right. We need to... So that one is a balance between making sure there's really good broad representation and having enough so that they can have these kind of conversations that Rich talks about and become effective as a group. So that's the balance we're always striving for. We do operate in a committee structure, and the way we do that is through, we're focused on three policy frameworks at the county. That's how we've organized our world to make it sort of manageable in Multnomah County, is we have an early childhood policy framework, a school age policy framework that's closely connected to the work Thomas was talking about, and a poverty elimination framework. And so those are the three sort of unifying pieces that we work with. And child abuse prevention falls under actually each one, but especially early childhood. And so we have committees that include commissioners and many community volunteers, and they have subcommittees. It's a fairly extensive structure for a small, you know, we're a smallish organization. Unit of Multnomah County.
You see me sitting up here struggling because we struggled with just getting trying to get the whole model cities together, which was in one small geographical area, and you've got all these competing interests over here that says we need the dollars too. Yeah. So I needed to ask that question of how did you structure yourself in order to achieve your objectives.
Thank you. Senator Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to know about how much money goes to your you get from the commission. And the second thing, I'm most familiar with the Sun Schools. And do you track, I'm always into this evidence base, and do you track the number of people who drop out that have been in Sun School versus not in Sun School, and I'm not sure what other things that the child abuse, rape, those types of things. I mean, we need proof that these programs are really making a difference in our children's lives, and I just want you to share a little bit of what you're actually tracking so we can see that they're really making a difference.
Sure, I'd be happy to. We receive, your first question, we receive we think annually, so approximately $5 million a year from the state. $4.2 million of that we pass through to service providers, and the remainder goes for operations. We also are the local community action board, and so some of our funds come from community service block grant dollars from the federal government. As far as And we have a staff of approximately 7.5 with a temporary person there. In terms of data, it's collected extensively for all of the programs that we fund. We actually have some funding criteria adopted by the volunteer commissioners last year, and we've got this great spreadsheet that tracks how their outcomes are going, what other funds they have, how they fit within our funding criteria. And so, for the most part, we don't directly contract with agencies ourselves. For the most part, other departments do. In the case of Sun Schools, the Department of School and Community Partnerships, that's led by Lorenzo Poe, is the one who provides that service and contracts for it. But they report the data back to us. And the committee that Thomas sits on, the school age council, developed the best practices research, which is very consistent with how Sun operates. It's actually the strongest model in the country around doing what we're supposed to be doing in terms of those kinds of collaborations. Since it's been reconfigured and restructured as of a little less than a year ago, they are collecting all that data. We don't have the outcomes for those pieces, and yet we do have the outcomes for a lot of the components that have been operating for years, and I can get you that information. I don't have the specific numbers with me today, but we can get that to you.
Okay.
And I'm it's real important to know about dropout rate. It's really important to know about child abuse. It's really important. And so those are the things that we need to know here.
Mickey, that's if you kind of make a note on that, because those are those outcome-based we're interested in. I'd like to just follow up with one question for you, Director LeBeau. You'd said that one of the frameworks is poverty elimination. The focus on the presentation is on children, which, you know, I understand that, although, you know, we really have very few children out under bridges. It's not Calcutta. It's not Bangladesh. Ooh. And so really what we have are children that are part of families. And so mm-hmm. we have children with problems. We have families with problems. Right. And the focus on elimination of poverty, I'd just like to have your comment on what are you doing to eliminate poverty, because the presentation was about all of the things that are being done to advertise the availability of resources so that people can have resources available to them. I mean, here's the fish, come eat. What are you doing to help teach people how to fish? I mean, so that they eliminate the poverty and not merely just meet needs.
Chair Richardson, that's an area that we're really working to make sure that a lot of our work does overlap in terms of really focusing on the children with the greatest needs and low-income children. And so you're right, it is a combination of making sure that they have access to what's available to them. And those are certainly easier strategies to pursue than actually eliminating poverty. There's no question. We don't have the same kind of control over the economic conditions around living wage and employers. And yet some of the strategies, some of the programs that we work with through the community do help build skills for families, or do help link them to education, and do help them to eventually move towards economic self-sufficiency. And there are also some of the programs we link people with are the tax credits. That the federal tax credits are a great way to lift families out of poverty, because the average tax credit return is $1,400, and it's enough to take a lot of families out of poverty. We also have a whole goal committed to working with employers who are especially small, and seeing if there are ways that we can help them, what we can do as a community. So we actually have a strategy right now where we're starting to interview small businesses around that strategy, because it is a hard one to get at.
Okay, well,
there's no question.
Thank you very much. We appreciate yes, Senator Card.
I just want to say to you, the other day when I was talking about economic development issues, these people's job is so complicated, simply because if you have three generations that have been unemployed, and what they're doing is making sure the kids have a good education, making sure they have food on the table, it's going to be hard to measure how you lift kids out of poverty unless you lift their parents out of poverty.
Absolutely.
And so what they're doing is putting food on the table for those kids so that they can have a right and access to quality education and other things. But unless we can figure out as a society, how do we get those two generations back into the workforce and properly trained to meet today's workforce demands? We're not going to do that. They're going to continue to have to feed the kids, have to answer to the problems that they have. And so it's a big problem. And that's why I've been saying to the state legislature since 1985, help me to deal with this triple-digit unemployment in northeast Portland, which is a part of Multnomah County. I don't think we understood what they were saying when they said poverty is moving east. Now, Senator, on my very right, that means it's coming to you.
It's only there.
That's exactly right. It's coming to Senator Manis Anderson, because the cost of living in northeast Portland, we all, by the way, have 98% occupancy in housing. And to buy a house in northeast Portland is so, the cost is so exorbitant that the average person can't even pay rent in North Northeast Portland. It's so high. So they're coming to farther east, and that's what it is. Mm-hmm. So whether we move it around or not, we're not going to get a handle on poverty until we can help give parents the kind of skills they need to get into the workforce.
Certainly. Right. And that's, of course, that's what I'm focusing on by the question. And it's one thing to say, you know, that we're helping lift them out of poverty because of credits, but all really that focus is on programs that lift them above what is defined as poverty. And so we have federal poverty levels, which is basically discriminating, saying if you're above that, you're no longer in poverty. Well, they may not know that. I'm sure they'd appreciate hearing that because they're still having a hard time since they make $9,800 a year, and they feel much empowered to know that they're no longer listed as poor. But, of course, with that means they no longer qualify for a whole series of programs. And so, you know, I'm just taking a second to mention, in support of what Senator Carter says, that if we focus on families and lifting families through jobs and so forth, and what Tom Schaefer said, they're doing the Hood River, that's a good idea, isn't it? That focus on helping keep children in high school and preparing them for college to try and get them, because if you go to college, your chances of making a living is tremendously improved than if you're merely qualifying for programs. Anyway, we appreciate all that you're doing, and it's a huge problem, and it takes people with your kind of commitment to make a difference in the life of a child and in their parents, because we save the family, we save the children. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Richardson and members of the committee. I know the next piece of the presentation is around our programs. I know we only have about 13 minutes left. Would you like us to go ahead and start and get as far as we can get?
Well, I think that we'd like to use every precious minute, so please let's proceed.
All right. So now I would like to ask Carol Weyer, the Deputy Director of the Commission on Children and Families, and Wendy Lebo to come back up. I'm not sure that when Carol's going to talk about the programs from a statewide level, and Wendy was going to talk just briefly about how they're implemented locally. We'll see how much time we have.
Thank you.
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Carol Weyer. I'm the Deputy Director of the State Commission on Children and Families. I want to briefly give you an overview of how the funds you designate to the commission are allocated to the local communities. I'd like to refer you again to the graphic that we brought. What our local commissions have described to you, the Hood River Commission and the Multnomah Commission, is how they spend the green line. Those are our locally invested resources. There are six funding streams that are allocated based on the population birth to 18 in each community. Those dollars are the dollars that leverage additional community dollars. Mm-hmm. And in the last biennium, the commission statewide leveraged $36 million. Approximately one-third of the funds that you designate to the commission, state general funds, go to locally leveraged resources. Approximately two-thirds of the funds go to that next level with the gold ovals. We like to call that our web of supports. Those are essential components of a child abuse system. In this committee yesterday and today, you've talked considerably about child abuse, and yesterday certainly raised the great concern that meth poses to all of us around the increase in child abuse. What I am happy to report to you is that the three programs that we fund through the Commission on Children and Families have decreased child abuse in each one. We will go into more of a detail on each of these programs in phase two, but I just want to run through the child abuse results for each of them. As you know, Healthy Start is a voluntary home visiting program created by the legislature. It's now in all 36 counties. It's currently funded at 47% of first births. The child abuse rate for children 0 to 2 in Healthy Start is almost half the rate of those not in Healthy Start. Also in another statistic I want to give you because it was raised yesterday is that Healthy Start has a very low rate of refusal for eligible families for intensive services. 91% of the families who are eligible agreed to participate in intensive services.
Next question.
Yes.
You said that if the chances of child abuse are half as much for those that are in Healthy Start than those that aren't. Do you know what the number is for those that aren't involved at all? I mean, just what the...
20 children per 1,000 children. And in Healthy Start, it's 12 children per 1,000 children.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Those are the intensive services, yes. A second component of our web of supports in child abuse prevention are the relief nurseries. Relief nurseries work with families who are well into the system. They may be already involved in the child welfare system. 98% are in poverty. 48% have substance abuse problems. 43% have a history of domestic violence. And 31% of the parents themselves were victims of child abuse. Relief nurseries provide a therapeutic childhood program, early childhood program, intensive parenting, outreach, and substance abuse services for parents. 97% of the children involved in relief nurseries have no subsequent signs of child abuse, and 99% of the children in relief nurseries are able to live safely with their parents, so therefore reducing the cost of being in foster care. We're very interested in this next biennium in strongly linking Healthy Start and relief nurseries. They're part of a continuum of services for families who are involved in child abuse prevention continuum. We're also working with local commissions to develop a rural model for relief nurseries. The third prong of our child abuse prevention system is the court-appointed special advocates, CASA. There are 31 CASA programs that serve all 36 counties. 3,927 children were served by CASA in 2003, and there are 1,233 active volunteers working with CASA kids. Every abused or neglected child in a juvenile court proceeding is entitled by federal law to a CASA. Only about 30% of the children in Oregon in that situation have a CASA.
Do you know how that compares with other states?
I don't know how it compares. I do know that it's a problem nationwide, but I don't know how we compare. I can find that out for you.
Can I ask the next question?
Certainly.
Thank you very much, and you might not know this, but I sure would like to know. When your statistics say 98.8% of Healthy Start children were free from substantiated reports of maltreatment, in comparison, 98% of the non-served children aged 0 to 2 years in the same counties were free from maltreatment. Who gets this data?
Who gets Chair Richardson, Senator Carter, I'm sorry, who gets to say
it? Does this data get to all agencies that are serving children?
No, these are the Healthy Start statistics out of our specific evaluation. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, but for instance, does Children's Services Division get this information?
Children. Yes, we would present it at Partners for Children and Families.
Right. You see, Mr. Chairman, what I'm trying to show is that these people are on the front line of doing this. And if they see, or who sees these children who are malnourished so that they won't be 5 years old and end up in hospital dead before we know that there is a problem? And you know, my question is that you guys are getting the data, but who sees these children first? Who knows that they're there? Somewhere, you guys help me out. You're the experts. I don't know this. I'm just asking the question to kind of get you going so you can tell us. Any one child is too many lost in the process. You have good data here. Who knows it? Who sees it? Who should have it that is not getting it? So another child, 5 years of age, looking like they're 2 years of age, have died from malnutrition. Do you guys understand what I'm saying? You're on the ground. I'm asking questions only because I want to know, not because I'm pretending to know.
May I introduce Karen Van Tassel, who's our Healthy Start State Director.
Treatment.
For the record, my name is Karen Van Tassel, Chair Richardson and Senator Carter. I'm the State Coordinator for the Healthy Start Program. And to speak to your question a bit, Senator Carter, first about where we receive the data that's on your sheet and how this comes to us. It's through a collaboration of the independent research firm, NPC Research, that undertakes the evaluation for the Healthy Start program, and the Department of Human Services through the Office of Family Health Database and through the Department of Human Services Child Welfare tracking of those abuse cases. So what they do is, on a yearly basis, give a data feed to the Healthy Start evaluation, comparing the number, the ID numbers of children who have substantiated cases of abuse and are also served by Healthy Start or are not. So that's where we get that difference in the percentages. And for 0 to 2 year olds, which is a comparable group, you know, in both cases, and then we come up with that result that 12 children per 1,000 who are involved with Healthy Start do experience founded cases of abuse, as compared to 22 children per 1,000 who are not involved with Healthy Start who have founded cases. So this is all about founded cases.
Would you mind defining what it means to be to qualify as being maltreated? I mean, what if we're not talking about murder, we're talking about a range, so what qualifies?
Right. Well, in the State Department of Human Services definitions of child abuse, it includes neglect, it includes physical abuse and maltreatment in that form, it includes emotional abuse, verbal abuse, being experiencing threat of harm, that's a significant piece, and being present for domestic violence. And then, of course, each county has a different threshold and a different process in their local Department of Human Services for which cases they investigate most thoroughly, you know. So there are variations throughout the state in how DHS implements their definitions of child abuse and neglect. But overall, that's it. So this is a measure that's objective, you know, that does actually get to the threshold of saying that there is a founded, substantiated case.
Okay.
Yeah. And who gets this information? I would love to see this information get out very, very broadly. And as far as access to it, it is reported as far as the abuse statistics touch the Healthy Start statistics yearly through our evaluation, which you have copies of the executive summary, and it is available on the NPC Research website and on the Oregon Commission website. And we do work to distribute it and to respond to the evaluation to improve the program.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Richardson and members of the committee, I'd like to take 1 minute to have Wendy Lebo describe how these programs work on a local basis.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
On a local basis, it's been great for us to get Healthy Start. We received funding with the statewide rollout in 2001, and so the fact that we are able to now screen at least half or more of the first births in the county means that families with these high-risk factors do have a way to get access into services which are provided in some of the most high-need parts of the county. They were rolled out that way on purpose. It also means that families with some risk factors who maybe have a few risk factors and some challenges, we can often refer to community programs early on. There aren't enough of them. I won't pretend that there are, but it's been a wonderful tool to do that. As was referred to, relief nurseries are a wonderful place for families where, as a referral source, when families are identified or self-refer, they just know they are on the edge of abuse. So that's been a very good piece. And CASA are some of our heroes locally. And there.
Mr. Chair, how many relief nurseries do you have in Multnomah County?
We have two relief nurseries.
And what is your waiting? How many is on your waiting list?
Chair Richardson, Senator Winters, we have two relief nurseries in Multnomah County, and I don't have those numbers in front of me. I can find that out.
Okay, thank you.
Through the Commission on Children and Families, we ensure that these child abuse prevention services are linked. They are linked through being part of some of the same committees. That's the sort of our good old-fashioned person-to-person linkage, which, as you know, is some of the most effective ways to make sure services get to the families in the way they need it and to identify gaps as they occur. One of those was the need for more learning opportunities. With budget cuts and lack of funding, fewer and fewer workers are getting as much training as we'd like to be able to see them have as a system. So we have a series of trainings that we have co-sponsored with other community partners to increase skill levels. That's just one example.
Okay. Thank you very much for that input and for taking the time to be here with us and giving us this information. And with that, we'll continue the rest of the business for tomorrow, and we are adjourned.
Mr. Chair, before you
almost adjourned,
I notice there are several directors and local chairs from local commissions. Could they just please stand and be recognized for all the good work you do? Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
They were shy.
Yeah. Thank you.
Except for all your work.
Yeah, Janet stood up right away.
We're Thank proud you. Of you, Janet. You've been through the crucible and have done good. Adjourned.